Many times in the history of the Earth, it's been like this, and then all of a sudden, something like that central object that's a painter's depiction of a 1 kilometer-sized object coming into the Earth. Now, I want to go over where they're coming from and a little bit about what they mean and what sort of hazard they pose. On this slide, on the left-hand side, is a photomicrograph. That is a picture taken through a microscope where you enlarge things by increasing the resolution. For example, if you had 2 small lines that were separated by 1/100 of a millimeter, your eye would look at it as a single line. We can only resolve something like 1/10 of a millimeter. But under a microscope, by changing the focal point of the lenses, you can enlarge things. So where we're looking at here, a 1 millimeter object embedded in some other minerals in a meteorite. And the colors in this case are the true colors that you would see with just plain light passing through a section of rock that is about 30 microns, 30,000ths of a millimeter thick. That's a standard thickness so that we see, compare one slice of rock with another slice with the same optical properties. So this is a little cross-section, a rounded object called a condrule. And these are melt droplets that exist in the dust clouds of our outer planets, probably, but also in the early history of the Earth, in the nebula, as we call the material that surrounded the early sun. And it's these small droplets, the first condensation from gaseous material in that nebula, which then concentrated specific elements, silica, and all the common elements that we have that make up our bulk Earth are in that little droplet. On the right-hand side is the same droplet called a chondrule, except now we're looking at that in light which has been confined by a polarizer to vibrate in one direction as it passes through material. After it's passed through the material, we put the analyzer at 90 degrees to that, and because light of different wavelengths, red through blue, travels at different speeds in a mineral, and at different speeds in different minerals, the light that is at 45 degrees to the polarizer in the analyzer gets through and recombines. And where we subtract out the red, it'll look blue, and where we subtract out the blue, it'll look red. And that polarized image can be used to identify minerals if you slice the mineral at exactly 30 microns. Then you can make up tables when you know the mineral from other evidence that it will have a blue color. So I do not have an image of this in cross-polarized light, but it would be black because if material is amorphous, it doesn't the light travels in the same speed in all directions, and so you get no effect like we see on the right. This means that particular image on the right is a grain that at some point when a chondrule like this was actually molten, it would have to be about 1200 degrees centigrade. If you cooled it slowly, you would nucleate different minerals. And the blue here is the mineral alloy, a magnesium iron silicate, and the white is a magnesium iron silicate, but it has a different ratio and a different symmetry. And those two minerals are very common in the material that we have actually been able to sample from the interior of the earth. In the volcanoes in Hawaii, now and then large chunks of rock are brought up that have beautiful green crystals in them. If we make a slice of it like this, it'll actually be blue. It's the mineral olivine. We can take that in the laboratory and we can determine that that rock, which is in the lava, in a very coarse grain rock, 2 or 3, 4 millimeters size crystals, could only exist at pressures about 50 kilometers deep in the earth. So that tells us where the Hawaiian lavas are coming from. And it's a chunk of the wall rock, or the crucible, that the molten material was in. So we see in this slide that in the meteorites we have the same minerals in very primitive forms and textures in the dust material that surrounded the sun in its early history. So the origin of the Earth is the story of the evolution of the solar system. Our knowledge comes from meteorites, and they are fragments of different asteroids. Their minerals and textures reveal the processes that formed them and are the basis for the classification of this complex natural group of materials that we call meteorites, and we'll go into that. The broad classification is that we find some that are 95 to 100 to 98, 99% iron with a few percent nickel. Others are all silicate, very much like that chondrule I showed you, but they always have a few flecks of metal in them. And then there are some rather interesting meteorites that are a combination of both the metal and the silicate material. After two and a half centuries of the study of these materials, the consensus view is now that they formed in very small planets that surrounded the early sun and the nebula. They were probably 1,000 kilometers in diameter. And at that size, they would have been sufficiently large, so if they were once molten, they would cool slowly, and you would get crystals, very much like I showed you in that first chondrule on the right. How could they become molten if they are formed from particles in the nebula that are crystallizing and have crystals in them? Well, gradually, as those small particles accrete under the force of gravity, they are coming together at high speeds, losing their energy, which is turned to heat, and if they get large enough, there's sufficient heat to completely melt them. So we believe the planetesimals were molten. I showed this the other day. You could use this as a model, not a direct analog, but Saturn with its rings, and this artist's picture of what's in the rings could depict in a probably the more concrete way than fanciful diagrams of the early nebula of the sun. Well, here's a cross section from studying meteorites, finally recognized that if they did come from a slowly cooling body, then there are different textures might make sense. And we see on the upper right photomicrograph again of material that has different colors and different shapes. And if I made a section of one of the black rocks from up near the mine, it would look very much like this. It would have these different minerals. Then there are a class of meteorites that have coarser grain minerals. And if we made a section of the material that we find being brought up by lavas in the earth, chunks of the inner mantle of the earth, it would look very much like this. And also in part like this. But then there are some very interesting meteorites that have a combination of metal. Here the metal is black. This is a plain light picture without the polarization. These are olivine crystals. It's a combination of early high temperature minerals crystallizing within iron. And you can duplicate this in a laboratory if you have an immiscible melt of metal and silicate, similar to the immiscible system of oil and water. That's one class of meteorites called pellicites. And then this is a sample collected on the Antarctic snowfield, which has been a great boon to people studying meteorites when they discovered that some of these black objects, you see this is about a foot from a helicopter, you could spot this. And that some 30 years ago, they first began to see these, landed and found out they were meteorites, which were being carried by the ice as it creeps off the Antarctic continent, just because of the height and the slow movement, comes across a range of mountains called the Transantarctic Mountains. The ice flows around and it leaves this debris behind. And thousands of meteorites have now been found. This is an example of an iron meteorite. So this, we think, the reason that we see this is that this particular plantesimal that produced this was large enough so that crystals could form from a melt and settle in toward the center under gravity. And the most dense thing, the metal, would sink the furthest. So the plantesimal has stratification, similar to what I showed the other day that the Earth has, of an iron core and then silicate minerals around it. But there has to be, of course, some other process which breaks these plantesimals up. And it's presumed to be the collision of the plantesimals moving in the orbits around the sun while the Earth was forming and the planets were forming. And these have all come to reside in a belt between Jupiter and Mars, which we call the asteroid belt, and another term for plantesimal is that it was an asteroid. And so maybe some of them that are there now escaped collisions and didn't break up into meteorites. Well, they are moving in this belt around the sun in orbits which change with time, and some of the orbits come close to that of Earth. And clearly, some of them have come within the gravitational field of the Earth and been pulled in and landed, impacted on the Earth. And on the left, the image of the moon, these black areas are large craters formed by the impact of materials in the early solar system on the moon. Later filled in by molten material, formed flat surfaces, which Galileo called mari, or seas. And the bright part of the moon is the ancient outer crust of the moon. Well, the process that formed those craters on the moon is the same process as recently as 40,000 years ago that formed Meteor Crater. I think I asked whether anybody had been to Meteor Crater. Well, I had never been there, so you can correct me. I won't say anything more about Meteor Crater, but it must be impressive too.
When I was there, they had a. Well, first of all, you have to pay. It's a privately owned.
I see. Right.
So you've got to pay admission to actually look into it. But then you look down into the bottom. There were trucks down there, and it was a good thing because otherwise you couldn't very well judge the size of it. It's so huge. But yeah, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, 730 feet. That's interesting that it's still a private property. A mining entrepreneur by the name of Barringer, back at the turn of the previous century, found that, one, the crater had been found earlier, and also fragments, very much like that one that I showed on the snow in Antarctica, were found strewn around it. And they had about 3 to 5% nickel in addition to the iron. And so he assumed, largely because the scientific community at the time did not realize that when an object that could make a crater like this is coming in at 15 kilometers a second, it's going to have such a high velocity that when it's stopped dead and that's all converted to heat, it's going to totally vaporize the object. He assumed that at depth there would be this big mass of nickel iron. And he spent his fortune, which he had made in smaller mining operations, trying to locate it, provided a lot of interesting material for people studying the nature of impacts. But of course, the gravity data now shows there's nothing there. Just a few of these fragments survived, and they're named Canum Diablo. Well, more recently, on October 21st, 1966, Rick Wirth woke up and went out to his GeoMetro and noticed this cauliflower-sized shattering of his windshield. The object that's sitting there now was not there. It was down in the windshield wiper well. And I think if he hadn't been a welder, he probably would have thought, well, just a couple of rocks that kids that always bothered me threw and broke my windshield, and he would have tossed them aside. But meteorites, when they come in impacting on the Earth at these high velocities, and they are slow, they do heat up and they form a minor crust, which is a rusty chocolate color, but very different than rust itself on other things. And so he just, as a welder, probably noticed that this is a little different than the things I see when I'm welding things. So he brought it into the department, and this is the first and only sample of the thousands that have been brought into the department that turned out to be a meteorite. And you should welcome Kathy Olin back to the room, who's the executive secretary in our department. She's the one that's had to tell these people that, well, yes, we could look at it if she could find it. On the right is a thin section of this meteorite. And you see the round feature again with the skeletal crystals growing in it, like I showed on the first slide. So this particular meteorite is one of this class that comes from the interior of a planetary body. So they're still impacting on the Earth. So you might ask, do we have anything to worry about this afternoon other than what is the meal going to be tonight? Well, things are coming in. And this is a plot showing the average time between impacts plotted in Earth years and the size of the object. And you'll notice 1 micron size dust particles, which you really can't see with the naked eye, are coming in every 30 thousandths of a second across the Earth. Now, on this diagram, it doesn't say how many are coming. But I think if you use current models, the dust of that type going up to the 1 millimeter diameter, given the rate that things are coming in now and estimates of what they might have come in the past, if there had been no disturbances in the Earth, there would be about an 80-foot thick layer of meteoritic dust. And it would be possible to recognize it chemically and mineralogically and distinguish it from the Mount St. Helens ashfall. But it would be very much like the ashfall. Now, unfortunately, the Earth is not like this white cover of snow in Antarctica. A lot of things happen on Earth, and so that layer has never accumulated. Some creationists use that as an argument that we don't know what we're talking about when we talk about the age of the Earth, because we should see that layer and we don't see it. Well, on the right, in 1906, there was an event, it's still called the Tunguska event in Siberia, that literally the world got wind of it, and the dust cloud that surrounded the entire Earth affected sunsets for months. Finally traced back to this place in Siberia, and when a number of geologists made their way back there through the swamps and the mosquitoes, they found all they found was that the trees were flattened, lying out flat. This is before aerial photography. And the lines that you see on there are roughly the orientation of these blown down trees. Since there's nothing there and there haven't been any little samples of silicate or iron meteorites, one of the conjectures is that it possibly was a comet. Again, shown over here, 65 million years ago, there was an impact about a 10-kilometer sized object that would fit where it showed that on the graph. And the evidence for the crater comes from measurements of gravity, which shows this circular gravity. This is the coast of Yucatan, and so it is buried. I've forgotten now the number of miles that it's actually buried, but these white dots are hot springs. And you notice that they sort of rim, this is something different, but these just rim the outline of this crater. So you can imagine this is much larger than Meteor Crater, but on the edge of the Meteor Crater, you might, if it had intersected the groundwater in the right places, it might have been fractures in which springs could develop. And that, of course, is associated with the extinction of the dinosaurs. Now, I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about a different kind of material. The debris that is thrown out when a meteorite makes a crater and you end up with a crater, obviously you have to put the material that was there somewhere else. And from the moon, we are able to map that, because on the moon there's been no running water, no wind to displace the material thrown out by impact. And so we can map out the rays and the layers of what are called ejecta blankets. About 10 years ago, two biology teachers in Thunder Bay, Ontario, having been told that there was an impact at Sudbury, Ontario, 2 billion years ago, concluded that if that's true, then there has to be some debris. And they began searching on weekends for some odd-looking material. They didn't know what to exactly look for, but they knew it had to be different than the usual rocks that are exposed in road cuts and so forth. And eventually they found this, and we now are able to study it. And a year ago, we discovered it in Minnesota. So I'm going to turn now to what we know about the Sudbury event. Just finish this off with a computer simulation. Tells you something about the drastic scale of the events when a 10-kilometer object hits the Earth. It's showing the temperature of material that is thrown out from the crater. And the final thing shown in the image in the back is 256 kilometers away from the impact. And the highest temperature, the yellow, is 5,500 degrees centigrade, about the temperature of the interior of the Earth. And this is 44 seconds after the impact. This just shows, again, where the temperature has gone down, things have cooled more on this side. In 122 seconds in this time-lapse experiment. Probably be coming back to this, but the event in Lake Superior 2 billion years ago, we believe, caused the extinction of the microscopic cyanobacteria that lived at the time, which were responsible in part for the concentration of iron that we have in Minnesota. It all came to an end very abruptly about 2 billion years ago. And this is a depiction of the amount of iron ore deposits that you find in the Lake Superior region with age. This is actually worldwide. Okay, well, let's go to the ejecta in Minnesota. Before we start out on this, do you have any questions about the... Well, this is a map of northern Minnesota, and the boundary with Canada is just above this. Gunflint Lake is a lake that lies in a geologic structure that's formed by a sequence of rocks from granites at 2.7 to iron formation that is in red at 2 billion years, and then some intrusions of igneous rocks at 1 billion years. Now it's interesting here at Holden, you have a similar section like this, actually depicted up in the cross section at the Portal Museum. The only thing is, these rocks are inclined only about 20 degrees in toward Lake Superior. Here, the sequence of rocks is inclined at about 70 degrees, but you have granites, no iron formation, but a lot of sediments. This is originally a mudstone, and then these igneous intrusions, of which the copper deposition, in your case here, is related to. Well, it's in this area that we found rocks which currently we're hopefully looking for definitive evidence that the quartz grains, which are, this is on the order of 50 thousandths of a millimeter, these are normally clear crystals in ordinary rocks. If they've been subjected to meteorite impact, they develop these planar features. And these have been found wherever this Sudbury ejecta has been found. And the large characteristics, the blocks and some rounded, interesting blueberry-sized fragments, which I'll show you, is the same in the Gunflint areas as in the area where these are found. So currently, we're actually looking for these. at Sudbury, it's presumed, because of the size of the crater, which is 160 miles across, that the object had to be 5 miles in diameter. So some quiet afternoon, when the area was covered with a quiet sea, a 5 mile object came in at about 15 kilometers a second, excavated all this material, and actually caused the deep earth down to 10, 15 miles maybe to be depressed, and then it bounced back. And then a lot of material fell back, and much of this was actually molten. And the current nickel deposit at Sudbury is found in the molten material that's solidified in here. Well, to put Sudbury in context and to show that we're not looking at an isolated phenomenon, it is the second oldest, and it's the fourth largest crater on Earth. One in Africa is larger and is the oldest, and there are several others that are larger than Sudbury. The Chicxulub you see here, and then these are smaller ones that have been found in other places. Here's one, Chesapeake Bay, just outside Washington, buried, that has finally been identified as a crater. There was a fire on May 16, 2007, and I was slated to help a colleague in the Minnesota Geological Survey run a field trip to show about 60 people the following week this interesting geology from here to here. And you can see the fire was blazing right across it. So my colleague Mark Gerson went to the fire control center here to find out if the fire eventually was put out or moved on, who would give us permission to actually run our field trip. We didn't want to show up with 60 people and have these people turn around and put up their hands. So he went up to find out, and after the meeting was over, he decided to go along this trail and look at some stops on that geology that I described, to see if what we put in the guidebook was actually there, just to double check. And while he was there, he noticed these unusual rocks that we had tramped over many times but never paid any attention to. And this is what the rocks look like. Now this is up in an area beyond where these are after the fire burned through. And this is looking down. This hammerhead is about 10 inches across. You see the outline of these little discs, which turn out to be spheres. They are not like the chondrules that I showed you, except that they were once molten material. And they form as the molten vapor of that ejecta cloud at very high temperatures is moving out, in this case, about 500 miles from the original crater. Little droplets of liquid begin to form more or less like raindrops. But as they cool, they solidify more like hailstones, and they collect debris of the dust and other particles that were in them. And they're given the fancy name lapilli. This is what we walked over and never paid any attention to for years until these biology teachers finally pointed out to us. These are the two teachers who found this material at Sudbury. This is the picture of material at Thunder Bay, and these are large fragments. And you see the similarity of this and what I just showed you. Here's that same year that we found this. We couldn't go up the trail, so the two biology teachers took us on a tour into Canada and showed us where they found this. Now you see it's in very obscure places, just along a ditch. And up until about 20 years ago, the geologists who saw this thought, well, that's odd, I can't figure that out, and they moved on to look at other things. Here's where it has been found, even some in drill core, over on the Iron Range this far in Minnesota. Now there are 170 structures like this, and Sudbury is the second largest, fourth oldest, and you can look this up on a database, and they describe all these 174 that have been documented with the planar features in quartz. This shows the geology a little bit like the cross-section up at the Portal Museum if you tilt this a little bit more. But these rocks are 2.7 to 1 billion years old. The ones here are maybe 300 million to down to the present day. So it looks like this complicated process that forms structures, strata like this, have occurred over and over again in Earth's history. These in blue are shown where so far on this scale of a mile, we have about 2 miles now. Whether or not this was continuous, one large mass dropped down here. At this point, we don't know. This is what the terrain looks like looking back on Gunflint Lake. And this is a cross-section of what Mark Jursa now has seen. This is about 20 feet of this material with the lapilli at the top and the karst fragments at the bottom. The iron formation with this age at the bottom and the mudstones at the top here at this age. So the impact had to occur sometime between 1878 and 1828. So during that interval is when it occurred. This is where sections schematic like that are drawn. I'll go through this rather quickly because it's going to go up and show what the geologist actually sees. You should see there has been some deformation, moving just a little bit higher. That's still higher. Still mainly fragments, and now you see these little pebbles scattered here and there in the rock. And above this are these billion-year-old molten masses of lava that are named after a Canadian geologist, Logan. There's the geology. This is the impact breccia. There's a little bit of the mudstone left here, and then this intrusive material. Well, this is what geologists submit in their proposals when they attempt to get a little bit of money to study this. We only have one person, and the time that I'm devoted to work on this in Minnesota, actually working on it. Well, this is some of the, there is an example in our rocks where we think we have these planar features, but we need to make a better section, find more of this before we can definitely say that this is impact quartz. Well, here are these lapilli, and when you section them, you can see that they have different textures and therefore must have different minerals and probably different chemistries. In addition to examining them in light, we can also examine these with an electron beam that we scan across it and get an image like you do in a television. And this is just the electrons that are scattered back. And if you have a high atomic number element in a mineral, it will scatter the electrons very efficiently and will look black. So the bright things here are iron, little iron oxide grains. And the others are minerals, silicate minerals, with different electron scattering characteristics. And then this is the matrix of the material. You can see that these probably have settled. They might have been soft when they settled. We don't have the orientation on this to be able to tell you that up was in this direction. This is looking at different elements in the lapilli. And you'll notice here when we look at the element calcium, which is the common thing that we find in limestones, that it seems to be in a circular structure, but also there is a vein that cuts it. And carbon does the same thing. And magnesium is very low, but brighter on the edge of that. And iron is very low. And so something has happened to this particular lapilli after it formed. We have more things to resolve than we actually know about this, but one of the views is that they're really kind of silicate hailstones, and they're sitting in a matrix of silicate slush, sort of like hail in fine ice slush. And these are just some pictures. And so, what's next? This is my colleague gave this talk. He used this and sort of made the point that this is the end of the story. This moose is examining the igneous rocks there. So, thank you. you can visit the Gunflint Trail. It's not quite as nice as Holden, but it's pretty nice.
I have a question. My question is, has anyone ever been hit by a meteorite?
Oh, interesting. There was a lady in Kentucky, I believe, Tennessee or Kentucky, sitting on her porch and rocking, and it did hit her leg. Now, whether it broke it, I don't know. But the only thing that we know, other than the cyanobacteria here, which were killed, but we know direct evidence of that, and the dinosaur extinction is now quite firmly attributed to that impact. But there is evidence, there is a record, this is very sad, a dog was killed by a meteorite. And I don't know if it was someone's pet, but that's the only record. If you go on the web and you Google meteorite impact Earth, you can get some interesting things. Back in the late 50s, well, it must have been more recently. You'll see why the 50s comes in there. People noticed a streak in the sky. Those are called meteors. Before the object, while the object is being heated up and it's glowing, all the way from Wilmington, Delaware, up to Peekskill, New York, and there's a time lapse thing. People's home videos, you put it together, so you actually know how fast that thing is moving across the sky. And also, meteorites, in addition to their classification, iron, and stony meteorites, there's a broad classification. A meteorite that is found after it hits right away is called a find. There are not too many of those. The ones that are, they're called falls. The ones that are found eons or years or weeks later are called finds. And this particular meteorite, the Peekskill, is a find. Is a fall. I'll get that straight. It's late in the afternoon. A fall because it didn't kill a dog, but it landed in the trunk of a 1950s car. So there's this dented trunk in that meteorite sitting there.
Well, what about Rick Worth? Was that a find or a fall?
That's a find because there were he was asleep and no one was there.
And no one saw it fall.
And they're named after where they are found. And even though his closest tax-paying residence is Turtle Lake, the land is part of the Clayton town.
What happened to that meteorite?
Well, he brought it over and we looked at it, and the dean of our Institute of Technology, I convinced him that it might be good outreach to purchase this meteorite so people could come and see it and know the history of it and so forth. And managed to cobble together $7,500. And I told him to go on eBay and see what he could get for it. He could have gotten $10,000. But he was sort of intrigued with all the trouble I went to help him identify it and everything. He said, I'll sell it for $75 because I want to buy a boat. And the boat was like $7,000.
So where is it sitting today?
It shows you that, now did he make a wise choice? Yeah, that was 1996. Katie and I find it hard to believe it's that long ago, 96.
Where is it today?
It's in a nice display in Pillsbury Hall.
Outside Kathy's office.
Right. Kathy can direct people to it, right?
Yeah. That was a 100,000-year meteorite that caused the extinction of the dinosaurs?
It was 65 million years ago, and about a 10-kilometer size object.
And that's something that size, if it hit the Earth again, would it wipe out the human race?
That size wouldn't, because it didn't There are many extinctions, like that one, and then this more older one of the cyanobacteria. Neither one of those, which are large craters, you know, 150 and 160 miles in diameter. The mammals, a large portion of living things, that survive. So certainly within range of that, within 300-400 miles, life would be obliterated. The total Earth. But it gets into the topic of, since the Tunguska event dust circled the Earth, would our sophisticated civilization be able to survive the change in climate that would be attendant with a dust cloud that would persist longer? Well, that's a good question, because that's at the basis of the current administration's effort to develop some way of, if an asteroid is coming in, to deflect it. And one of the justifications for their developing this sophisticated detection capability, which really has a military use, for which we don't really at the present time have any enemies that are capable of throwing anything up at us.
But that was a big enough event to
change the climate.
Get rid of the dinosaur.
Yeah, that they. It was debated for a long time that, whether or not that was what caused the extinction. But debris from that has been found widespread around the world, a thin layer of meteoritic.
I'm curious about the cyanobacteria. Did it wipe all the cyanobacteria out? Or?
Well, must not have wiped the world out worldwide, or you and I wouldn't be here today.
Right.
But it must have in the Lake Superior region. It was over. Yeah. Now, how fast in the oceans cyanobacteria migrated back? It's sort of similar to the forest fire that wipes out the trees. Immediately, nature begins to recover. It has its mechanisms. Yeah. Interesting question.
Question.
Yeah.
The annual meteorite showers,
mm-hmm.
The one in August and December.
Right. Yeah.
Is that debris from the asteroid belt?
Yeah, and it's debris that is in a certain orbit that comes close enough to Earth that it affects the upper atmosphere. But none of those, we call those meteors when you see the glow in the sky. It's a meteorite if there's an object that you actually eventually get from. But those are just, that is material in these orbits from the asteroid belt. I haven't seen or haven't looked into the literature in the evolution of the solar system. Why did all this broken up material of planetesimals end up between Mars and Jupiter? Now, it must have something with the gravitational interaction of a large mass like Jupiter, a smaller mass like Mars, and then the debris that's left in the solar system. Do you know of it?
I was just contemplating whether it might be a similar mechanism to what makes the rings of Saturn, for example.
Yeah.
But certainly Jupiter being the second largest thing in the solar system is...
It's almost the sun.
So, yeah, it's got to be involved somehow.
Yeah.
But I don't know the mechanism either.
Well, we've learned a lot at Holden that you don't really have to worry about a lot of things.
things that you do when you're not here. And but meteorite impact is before you get too casual and think that, you know, that we pretty much control our world and our environment, its fate. That's pretty much in the hand of the watchmaker, or however you want to refer to it, that's holding those things in those orbits. There is a general decline from large, if you look at the moon, it was interesting that the early people who studied the moon were divided into two groups. One looked at images and they just mapped the elevation changes and the shapes of things. And the others, when I was among them, were working on the chemistry and the mineralogy and the age and so forth. And in the sessions, the two groups had simultaneous sessions. And about the third conference, I decided it's just too much noise and chatter and people shouting at each other. And that isn't the way it is. Didn't you do this or didn't you do that? I thought I'd go over and listen to the four geologists. And there was a young person from Brown University giving a talk summarizing what they had learned up to that point. And it seems rather simple, but it turned out to be very profound. They used the simple notion that if you have a circular crater and another crater cuts it, clearly this one that cuts it has to be younger than the one that's cut. It's the same thing we use, that if rocks have not been overturned, the one on the bottom is older than the one on the top. And it seems so simple that why consider that a way to study things? But they had worked out the succession of things on the moon, and they had come across a couple of very interesting things. The big craters were the oldest, and the number of craters per unit time, per unit area, decreased as you got to younger and younger layers of craters. And so that's sort of telling you that the early impacts were large, and that material swept up faster in the nebula than the small material. It's almost the very same thing when you sweep up a room, you know, you get big things first. But now it turns out there are exceptions on Earth, because the Chicxulub crater is about the same diameter as the Sun crater, and they're separated by 2 billion years. So Chicxulub is anomalous in being a large crater.
Well, all you're saying, though, is that in general, the larger ones are older.
Yeah. Right.
There's always exceptions to things like that. So it only takes one exception to
might be the,
ruin your whole
the
day.
Exception. Now, it's a little different than Mount St. Helens, because you had time to move away, and even but some people just still didn't move away. But if you have a 5 mile diameter object coming, you're going to have to get 400 or 500 miles away, and you may not have enough time to do that. Well, on that happy note,
you can't worry about things you can't control.
I don't know. I guess I wouldn't take the train.
Enough things that you can control.